I'm an alcoholic. My name is Pat Lavis. I want to welcome all of you to the 25th annual North Coast Roundup, and I hope you have one heck of a weekend. My sobriety date is September 19th of 78, and that means I was privileged to be at the first North Coast Roundup, and I made 24. 1 year I was in Ireland. Excepting for that year, I've been here. And I watched this thing grow from infancy to what it is today. I can remember the year we had about 4,500 people in here. The aisles were full. They were on the steps. The fire marshal showed up. He threatened to close us down. And one brilliant AA walked up to him and said, "Try to close us and you'll see a riot like you've never seen before." He did not like to be threatened. So I was sent in to negotiate. And in the negotiations, I said, "No, there won't be any violence, there won't be any threat. There might be an organized boycott for several years to come for thousands of people who won't come to this city, but there won't be a riot." He said, "Clear the aisles in 10 minutes and I won't close you." And that's why there's a limit on the number of tickets that are available. And also, 1 year, our comedian got out of the car to come in the front door for the comedian show. And Seaside Finest picked him up and took him away in their car. And Harlan was saying, "We're going to have to cancel." But we made a few phone calls and a little bail money and a little niceness, and he was here. The comedian show went on. And I welcome you all to Seaside, and I want to tell you something. There is sun here. The old timers say, if you stay in Seaside long enough, you'll see the sun. And that's true. I told you that I am an alcoholic before I told you my name, because I never forget, want to forget what I am. What I am is more important than who I am. If I ever forget what I am, who I am isn't going to make a damn. And it's really important to remember that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who love each other and share our experience, strength, and hope. You're going to hear some great speakers this weekend, and I really enjoyed Beverly's Al-Anon talk. That was fantastic. Thank you. I didn't have a program early enough to get all the speakers' names down, but some of them are familiar with me, and they're really good. I should tell you that I'm CIA, Catholic, Irish, and alcoholic. And that makes life a little difficult, especially when you add to that the fact that I'm a lawyer. That really is an anchor. I was born in Anaconda, Montana, Harlan, in 1934. And I want to thank the committee for asking me to be here at the 25th. It's a real honor and pleasure to be here. There's some real great ghosts in this room, and many of the stars have their names on them that were involved in the early years, and I thank the committee for inviting me and the beautiful flowers. This is a committee effort. In talking, all the speakers always saying, "Thank you, Harlan." I thank you too, Harlan, but Harlan is just a member of the committee, but he's the organizer, and he's been with this thing for a lot of years. Originally, the organizer was Marcia. And the organizer kind of keeps it together and makes the idea that it's got to be fun as well as AA. And Harlan's done a great job at doing that. And you always become controversial, and a lot of people take your inventory when you're the organizer, and you have to have a skin that can take that kind of criticism. And he does, and that's why we have a great roundup. Now, when I grew up and was born in Montana, my dad was a mortician, and he died when I was 2 years old. I really wanted to help my mom because she has such a hard life and had to live all alone. So when she asked me on the beautiful sunny days if I would give up going swimming with my friends to sit alongside of a corpse during the wake, because there were lulls in the time when people were around, and every mortician lived in great fear that a cat was going to get an ear or a nose, and then the embarrassment would be terrible. So I was a cat watcher babysitting a dead corpse. Now that is boring, let me tell you. you talk and there's no response. But anyway, the great thing about it was when you walk into the wake, there was a table like this, a long table with a candy bowl on it, just full of chocolates, and several bottles of whiskey, shot glasses, and water. And every man that came in would get at least three shots, hoping nobody was counting, and the women would take and put candy in their purse, plus eat three or four. And during a lull, I would want to sample the goodies, not the candy, just the goodies. So I would pour a little whiskey in a shot glass, but I didn't want to get drunk because that would blow my cover and I'd get fired. So I was very careful. And I learned right off that it was really hard to down just a little bit of whiskey. It burnt like hell. But I tried and I tried and I mastered it. It was an early sign. And I want to say something tonight. If anybody disagrees with me, that's fine. My opinions on my life in Alcoholics are mine. You don't have to agree. If you misunderstand me, please feel free to discuss what I said to get clarity. Reminds me of the little boy doing his homework, and he said, 2 plus 2, the son of a bitch is 4. 4 plus 4, the son of a bitch is 8. His mother walked in and says, Johnny, what are you doing? He said, my homework. And he said, your language is terrible. And he said, that's the way the teacher said to do it. The next morning, before school opened, mom's at the school. She grabs the teacher and says, what are you doing to the kids? Teacher said, I'm teaching them simple math. What do you mean teaching them simple math? Johnny says, 2 plus 2, the son of a bitch is 4. What's that? The teacher smiled from ear to ear, which made mom madder than hell. She got her composure and said, I'm sorry. He misunderstood me. What I said was, 2 plus 2, the sum of which equals 4. So, if there's an understanding, a misunderstanding, let's talk about it, but don't argue with my convictions, because they're mine. But early on, like 18 years old, I went to a wedding reception, and I got a glass of whiskey, and it was great, and I drank it straight, and then another one, and then another one, and then a bunch of us guys went out in a rowdy fashion. And it wasn't long before those lights came looking for us. And we all ran. And I couldn't get away because I couldn't get over a damn fence. And I'm struggling to get over the fence, and the cop arrested me. I immediately vomited all over the side of his uniform. But in the small town, he was my cousin. He took his penknife and he scraped it off his arm and said, where did you get the chili? And I said, it's not chili, it's peanuts. And he said, where'd you get the chili? And I said, it is not chili, it is a peanut. And he said, where did you get it? I said, I'm not answering questions, I want a lawyer. I might incriminate myself. And he says, dumb little turkey, ought to be a lawyer. And I thought, that's a good idea. So I followed through. But anyway, the drinking escalated. And God tried to teach me something that night. Because instead of the society then looking at us as young men who might be inflicted with a terminal disease of alcoholism, AA was just barely in Montana. In fact, it was hard to find. It was an embarrassment to the school and our families, and we had to apologize to the student body. And I was so embarrassed because the damn fence that got me caught was a wooden sidewalk, and I was on my hands and knees and didn't know it. The lesson that I didn't get, God was trying to tell me, take a simple problem, add alcohol, and you can't solve it. Take a simple problem, be sober, and it's no problem. The solution comes to you. But I didn't figure that out. The drinking escalated. When I went to college, I went to Gonzaga University. It was a Jesuit school. I never should have got in because my grades weren't good enough, but my uncle was about to become the provincial. He was a Jesuit priest, and with people in high places, I got into Gonzaga, and I stayed there and had fairly good grades and decided to go to law school. But I was drinking all the time, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. St. Patrick's Day, We dyed the beer green, we dyed our hair green, we dyed the milk green, we dyed our private parts green, we dyed everything on earth green. And that night, next day I woke up and there was a young lady sleeping beside me in a bed and nothing happened, but I didn't know it because I didn't remember. A thing called a blackout. And the first thought I had is, my God, if something happened, would the baby be green? That scared the hell out of me. But, you know, fear keeps an alcoholic sober, 6 hours? Anyway, it was getting worse, but I learned that I was never going to get anywhere in law school drinking the way I drank. So every time near the end of the semester, I'd sober up for about a month and study and got very good grades. In fact, I ended up 12 out of 10, out of 52 in the class, and in law school, grades don't come easy. I took the bar and I was scared to death. And when the results came out, I called up the newspaper and said, did I pass it? And the guy says, what's your name? And I said, Hayes Patrick Leavis. And he says, no, all we have is a Lekas and Lucas in the L's. And what was your name? And I said, Hayes Patrick Leavis. He said, we have a Patrick Leavis Hayes. Could that be you? And I said, that's me. And I started out practicing law. And the only way I could practice law was to make the cocktail party every night. I got married and had 3 beautiful kids, Pat, Kathy, and Aaron, but my alcoholism was out of control. My wife had no understanding of the disease, and it wasn't long before we divorced. And she took the kids to Portland and began to put a wall between the kids and I, and her father-in-law, who never did like me, my father-in-law, her dad, continued to add cement to the wall, and I just couldn't get through to my kids. My drinking kept going. I didn't get drunk driving tickets because I was the city attorney, and I got our police force excited, and I helped raise their morale. And when I was drunk, they would come in the bar and say, Pat, you touch a wheel tonight, you go to jail. Take a cab home. And I had an enabling force that wouldn't quit. And that accelerated my drinking, and I would take off for 4 or 5 days. I would usually get a brick of cheese, a box of Ritz crackers, a half a gallon of vodka, and hole up in a motel. And if I went out for anything, it was more vodka or gin. And it was beginning to affect my health, like my eyes were turning green. My organs were shutting down. I had the shakes. My life was in turmoil. I couldn't read my handwriting on the signature of my checks. I was completely irresponsible. I met another young lady, and she needed Al-Anon because she didn't see anything wrong with me, and she married me, and we had 2 beautiful little girls, Honor and Megan. And my life was going down the toilet. My partners were threatening me. The judges were going to turn me into the bar, and I would sit there at night knowing my life's in shambles, my career's on the line, and if I take one drink, I won't quit, I'll get drunk, but I need one. So I'll take one. And you know what happened? One was 50 and drunk again. The drinking got so bad that they put together an intervention, and the intervention catapulted me into St. Joe's, a treatment center that was AA-based. And I stayed there for 28 days. I had to stay 35 because the first 5 days I had what they said was mild delirium tantrums. And I say mild because they said I wasn't disoriented, other than the fact I thought I was in a motel. I didn't see animals, I didn't see creatures, I didn't hallucinate, but I wasn't in touch with reality. And I kept trying to escape. And one night I decided, tonight I'm going to get out of this joint. I took off all my clothes and took off all down the hall, streaking. And here comes a nurse with a man bringing his wife in for treatment, and here I come this way. She said, God damn it, Pat, get out of here. And I went into a closet, and there was an ice machine. I could hear the ice go clink, clink, clink. And little bits of it come to me because I don't have clear remember of it all. But when I found out what I did, I was so embarrassed, but I had to have that ego machoism, you know. The nurse threw me towel and said, Pat, wrap this around you and get to your room. I wrapped it around my head and marched back to my room. trying to look good, as we all try to look good. I went up to her the next day and I said, Patty, and she had about 25 years in recovery then, now that you've seen the Lavis family jewels, you'll never be happy at home. And she said, Pat, don't excite yourself, because little things don't impress me. Who knows? And a recovering alcoholic has got a quick wit, right? Anyway, when I came out of St. Joe's, I scoffed at this program. I had no intention of staying, but I agreed to stick around for a few months. And I started coming to meetings in Seaside because I didn't want anybody in Astoria to know that one of the better lawyers in town, at least I thought I was one of the better ones, was a recovering drunk. And it turned out there were only five people in the group that I went to every Tuesday night, and I was elected alternate GSR. The GSR got sick, and at 2 months sober, I'm in a state assembly. And I met Lenny, who was a great guy. And my life continued along with AA, and I found a sudden realization that everything was better with Alcoholics Anonymous. Life was better, it was clearer, I could read my signature, people weren't threatened to do bad things to me, I had less pressure and less tension, and I thought this might work, so I decided to hang out a little longer, and things got even better, and I got addicted to this thing, and I have absolutely no defense against the next meeting. By the way, my home group is the Spiritually Superior Saturday Morning Men's Group. And there's a story behind that, but I won't tell you tonight, because we used to take a lot of guff, because it was the first men's meeting in Astoria. Anyway, I began my road to sobriety, and somebody says, you've got to get a sponsor. I looked around, and I had Doc John originally, who was involved in the first roundup. Many of you may know Lois and John. Lois died about a year and a half ago, and she was a wonderful woman. John had died earlier. And they taught me a lot about the program. But there's so much to learn in this program that we can stay here a lifetime and never touch it. I'm firmly convinced that if you take a willing person who will try to work the 12 steps, find a loving higher power that they can put their faith in, you create in that individual a power greater than anything on earth that can weather all of life's storms without ever taking a drink. This program has got more to offer than just not drinking. And I began to figure that out. And I lost Doc John, so I had to get another sponsor. And I wanted to find somebody who knew what life was all about. And I find a guy we affectionately refer to as Doc John. He's sitting over there, and he's only got 52 years. But you think I can snow him? I can try, but no way can I snow that man. And we're very honest with each other, and that's a priceless gift, because I think without a sponsor, you're in real trouble. If you sponsor yourself, you could get into real serious trouble, like a relapse. You need someone to talk to. That's part of the magic. When I talk to another alcoholic or a group of alcoholics, and I have a problem and talk about it in a general way, I can get insight from that power greater than myself through my own words as to the solution. I don't have to get feedback just talking to another alcoholic. I can tell you understand, and your understanding gives me the insight into me that makes it work. And it's really strange because I lived in a fantasy world, never in the now, and I would look at the bar where the cigarette smoke was so clear, thick you could write your name on the mirror, and fantasize having my own law firm, my own building, and having a good injury firm to represent injured people, Social Security, workers' comp, and not be worried about fees all the time. Get a settlement from the insurance company, like Robin Hood, take from the rich and split it with the poor. And I liked that philosophy, but I couldn't get it going. And in 12 years, at number 12, in recovery, I got my own building, had three lawyers working for me, and everything was in high gear. I was living everything that I believed I'd never see, but would fantasize about because of Alcoholics Anonymous. and what a gift. And when I look back at all of my life that I spent drinking, which was till about age 43, and I had regrets for a while till I realized I have to accept the past. The wreckage of the past can be a great teacher, but I can't dwell on it. And I was satisfied with where I was. And I didn't think anything in this life could be anything but great, lots of sunshine. And then on August 1st of 1991, my daughter Erin, who I had begun to reconnect with, and I had worked hard to reconnect with Erin, because I really love that tyke, and my son Pat, and they were communicating with me. And Erin got promoted at the VA hospital and was going to Arizona to her new job. And on the way, in Reno, Nevada, she lost it on a curve and died in a one-car collision. The light went out of my soul, and it got very cold, and I got very angry with a loving God. I grew up Catholic, but I couldn't stand a loving God. How could a loving God take a young girl away with her life just starting to unfold ahead of her, who wasn't showing any signs of any addiction? It just wasn't fair, and I was extremely angry. And then all of a sudden, listening to you and the speakers, because many of us have lost a child, I pray that nobody else experiences again, but in all probability somebody in this room will within a year. Go to meetings and talk about it. That's your best weapon. Eventually, you can write your program, but it will go on tilt. At least mine sure the heck did. And I didn't know what the heck I was going to do, because Erin was just beginning to listen to me and we were just starting to communicate. I was so sad, and my kids understood. And my daughter Anna was really supportive, and she would sit with me and hold my hand and we would cry. And I thought, well, maybe I can make it. And then 9 months later on August 19th on Easter, by the way, the curve that Erin died on, in the next year, 11 people died, and the state of Nevada finally changed the centrifugal force on the curve. It was wacky. My daughter, Honor, on Easter Sunday morning, was in a one-car collision that resulted in her death. And I quit. I really quit inside. I had no more fight left. But what did I do? I knew enough to come to meetings. I refused to talk to God. I was so angry at God, I used nothing but profanity when everybody mentioned his name. I had no use for higher power. I had no use for spirituality. My life was in the pits, and I wanted nothing, nothing at all, except to get well. And I kept talking, and I kept listening. And eventually, the program righted the ship, and I got it kind of floating. Now, I want to tell you, when I got sober, I was worried about my two young kids, Honor, who is now gone, and Megan, who was then about 5 years old. And Megan became my go-to-meetings buddy. We went every Wednesday night to the hospital meeting in Astoria. And she loved to go to the meetings, and she loved to say that the Our Father at the end of the meeting. One day we're in church, which is a Catholic service, and during the Mass they say the Our Father, and there's a slight silence. And this little voice peeks up and says, "Keep coming back, it works." And in about 10 seconds, I heard some scattered laughs around the church. And I knew several people had a mini meeting and a shot of spirituality from a five-year-old who really didn't know what she said. And today she's a teacher in Salem and just recently got engaged. My son Pat and I began to get closer. But my daughter Kathy, she was really brainwashed, and she would have nothing to do with me. For 7 years in sobriety, I would write long notes with her birthday and Christmas gifts, never get a response or a thank you for the gift, call and they'd tell me she wasn't home when she was. I just couldn't get through to her. I finally sat down and made a tape reset recording of an amends to her, said a prayer that she wouldn't play it to my ex-wife, and sent it to her. I learned that she got the cassette, took it out, took a scissors and cut the tape and never played it. She was just untouchable. And I just said, well, God, I've done everything I can do, whatever, which is a real short form of the Serenity Prayer. And by golly, nothing changed. She graduated from chiropractic school. She went up to Tacoma and started her own business. And an older chiropractor, older than I am, became her mentor, Dr. Anderson. And every time I heard about Kathy, she was doing this and that with Dr. Anderson. He gave her some earrings. She wore the earrings all the time. He wanted to take a trip to Hawaii. They told him he should have somebody accompanying him. She went to Hawaii with him, and I understand talked about that trip for weeks. And that was really getting under my skin. I had a resentment for that Dr. Anderson, where I really wondered how I could get even, how I could do something to derail that son of a gun. I love water now that I learned I can drink it straight. Anyway, Dr. Anderson was a real nemesis, and the first time I had a resentment to work on. I tried to pray for him. I couldn't do it. In fact, after the death of my two daughters, I couldn't even make a gratitude list. But my daughter, Kathy, just would have nothing to do with me. And I thought this Dr. Anderson was the slimiest man that ever walked the face of the earth. He had no right taking my place with my daughter. And somehow, some way, I was going to get even. I thought I had analyzed this perfectly. And one night I'm working at home and I get a phone call. And the voice on the phone says, "My name is Carl, I'm an alcoholic. We have a speakers meeting in Tacoma, and we would like you to be our speaker. It's the Saturday before Father's Day. Do you mind coming up here with your family and be our guest for Father's Day?" And I said, "No, I'd love to come." And he says, "Fine." I said, "How do I get a hold of you?" And he said, "Just a minute, I'll give you my phone number." And he said, "When you call, they're going to tell you Dr. Anderson's chiropractic clinic." And he had about 38 years of sobriety. He knew what he was doing all along, and I thought I knew what he was doing. I didn't know nothing. He called all his favor, twisted my daughter's arm, and she attended that speaker's meeting. As a result, the wall crumbled, and one night, we became extremely close. We talked three or four times a week. She's given me a grandson that is the apple of my eye and part of my life. And I can't believe how it works. You know, and I had thought I knew what was going on, but things are never as they appear to be. Trust God and wait for the whole story to unfold before you jump to conclusions. And what a way to learn that lesson, but I did. And anyway, I found that everything could go right, despite the fact of the loss of the two kids. And things were really humming along. And then in January of 1993, I had a stroke. When I woke up, I couldn't move my left arm or my left leg, and I was in a wheelchair. This was really a different experience. I'm in a rehab clinic. And it was miserable there because they work you 24 hours a day virtually. Everything is scheduled. Breakfast, reading, speech therapy, physical therapy, exercise, speech therapy, lunch, a little rest, therapy, and then at night you got to go out. They made you go to dinner or go to a movie in wheelchairs in a van so you wouldn't become a recluse. And I hated it. I kept asking the doctors, "Will I ever move my left arm? Will I ever walk?" And they kept telling me, "A stroke is a stroke. It has a life of its own. Just keep doing your therapy and see what happens." And I said, what a way to tell me, trust God. So I kept doing my therapy, and pretty soon they called me in and they said, "We believe you got a problem because you've lost two daughters, you've had a stroke, you've lost your independence, you're in a wheelchair, you can't move your left arm or leg. We want you to look at some antidepressants." I am not opposed to antidepressants. If you need them and a doctor tells you to take them, for God's sake, take them. But I asked them, could you arrange 15 minutes in the morning where I could go someplace in quiet and read out of a couple books that I'm kind of fond of and see how my depression goes one way or the other? And they'd agreed to do that. And after 4 weeks, they reevaluated me and said, well, maybe we jumped the gun. You don't need to start them right now. And again, it's the prayer and meditation in step 11 that saved me from probably depression. I really believe that this program can solve all the problems, but it is not the solution to a medical problem. Do what the doctors tell you. And before long, I was walking with a walker, but I was walking, and slowly I began to walk, but I kept asking God, you know, whatever your will for me is, I really want to walk. And I forgot to put in, and I'd like to be able to do stairs. Stairs are still a barrier. Should have asked, but I didn't, and we get what we asked for. I think I opened and closed my hand and worked the putty probably close to 1,000,000 times, and it just wouldn't open. And one night I'm sitting in an AA meeting, and I looked at it, and it opened. It took months to try to type, and now that I can type, I like the internet, and I belong to some AA meetings online where you email each other, not chat, email on a topic, and it changes every week. But my little finger can never find the cap sign. It always gets control. And on a computer, if you hit control in a letter, you get a dialog box. So I put it on cap, and I don't reach for it. I type in all caps. People who don't know me this email me and say, why are you shouting? And I'm not shouting. It's the best I can do. And I can only do the best I can do. And I believe that the 12-step work should always be done. And in the early days, I did lots of 12-step calls. We had a 12-step list, and we didn't have an answering service, so we hired the ambulance service to be our answering service, and they would take the calls. I gave them a list of people who would do the 12-step calls, and I was number one, and Jerry Law, a young man who I sponsored who died of a heart attack, was number two. And it kept being me and Jerry. And finally I called up and says, you're supposed to go down the list, not start over with every call. But it really didn't hurt me. Every one of those calls enriched my program. And if my health hadn't failed, I would still do more 12-step work with the hotline. I suggest that everybody gives it some thought. It's a fascinating experience. Just don't plan for any success. Do the 12-step and let the result go, and you'll find it much better. And that's what I was doing, just like I made the judgment that I knew what this Dr. Anderson was doing in my daughter's life, dead wrong. And listen to tapes from other speakers. They have so much to offer. And listening to speakers, you pick up so much. Sometimes you don't realize it at the time. And if the longer you stick around this program, the more you realize the importance of giving. Don't worry about the payback. Just give all you can. The rewards will be beyond your belief. I recovered from the stroke. I've got over the depression and grief of losing two daughters. A year ago, I had a serious cancer operation. They took out part of my colon. They got it all. I didn't have any follow-up treatment. I thought that was great, and got complications to the surgery and had to be shipped to Portland. I was in a hospital another 12 days. I was so sick I couldn't believe it. I never thought I'd have any energy again. But you do what you have to do and you just keep doing it and let the result fall. Be willing to accept it no matter what it may be. I really believe that there is a God there. It does listen to us. It does help us. The answer may not come immediately, and nor the help immediately, but don't give up the faith in your spiritual program, because I think without the spiritual program, your life will never experience the complete power of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this program has no end to what it can do for you. It's really amazing and to have a wonderful group of people like you here tonight. And there's something I've never talked about before in meetings or from the podium because I'm embarrassed to talk about it, but I'm going to talk a little bit about it tonight. and that is, I think it's extremely important to watch out for the ego. When I was young in the program, I realized the ego was my nemesis. There's a beautiful American, Native American prayer. It's really a tremendous prayer. And the last sentence is, O Great Spirit, please give me the strength to defeat my greatest enemy, myself. And I believe that's so true. It took me years to realize the ego was my downfall, because that was the little voice inside my head that says, you're not alcoholic. You can quit whatever you want. And I believed it. It was a good answer. If they say you're drinking too much, drink less. Or try drinking just beer or just wine. You'll find a reference to that somewhere in the big book on alcoholism. And I believed it. You know, if anybody had a wife like you have and a home like you're living in, they'd entitle to a few drinks. And I believed it. With all the stress you have at work and your financial pressures, you deserve to let your hair down and have a few drinks. And I believe it. And one won't hurt you. I was a sucker for that one. And I realized that ego was my nemesis, so I capped it. And I hate to tell you, but about 20 years sober, I felt there was something wrong with my spiritual connection. And because of what I learned in rooms like this, I realized that maybe that ego I thought I had locked up escaped the jail and was becoming my nemesis again. I now believe I want to crush my ego to dust. I don't need it. It's nothing but trouble. And I began to realize that it was popping its ugly head up. I'd take a 10th step at night and think, I hurt Joe's feelings. I owe him amends. And the little voice would say, he's immature and so sensitive. You didn't say anything to hurt his feelings. He's just too sensitive. Forget that amends. You don't have to make it. And I bought it. And the voice would say, nobody understands you. What you're doing is okay. Don't worry about it. And I hear many of my friends say this, but I'm not married now, so didn't get into it. My significant other invited her family down for the weekend, and she didn't consult me first. You know, that's ego. Or she made plans for dinner Friday night and expects me to go, and I didn't hear about it till Friday morning. You know, that is ego. And the excuses it can come up with are never ending, and they always appear to be right. And I realized that it was building up a wall that was interfering with my spiritual connection, and that I had to look back at 6 and 7 and look at my shortcomings, because the worst thing it was getting me, and I didn't even realize it until one day, you know, the first time I got into a predicament, well, make up what sounds good. It doesn't have to be true. Just frosting the problem. Don't worry about it. And then lying becomes more and more habitual. And lying leads to secrets, and secrets and lying are real sicknesses to my soul. In this program, I've learned to self-analyze myself and not be afraid to go where I haven't gone before and not to worry about looking good. And I also try to stay in the now. You know, if you're dyslexic and if you spell now backwards, it's W-O-N, you win, you've won. But if you don't stay in the now, you'll make tomorrow the busiest day of your life, today. And you will find Miss Right, you lose Miss Right, you'll make a lot of money, you'll lose a lot of money, you get the job that you like, you could be completely exhausted, it took place in 30 minutes and you never got out of your chair. You know, that mind can just take you anywhere it wants to go, and we can't let it do that. To stay in the now is stay in the moment. When you start to fantasize too much, ask God to keep you in the now. It works for me. And by staying in the now, I seem to be able to keep myself collected, which is something that I really want to do on a daily basis. And don't forget where we came from. About 1980, the Oregon State Bar realized that maybe alcoholism was a disease, and maybe they should look into it. So they asked lawyers to volunteer for committee, And it was pretty obvious if you volunteered, you were telling all the world you're an alcoholic in recovery. And again, it's strange. 12 lawyers volunteered for that committee, and I was privileged to be amongst the 12. We made an alliance with the doctors to work with them, and we would still be working with them, but they have a real strict program where you have to come forward and confess. You have to enter into a 10-year monitoring program, taking blood, saliva, or urine tests whenever they want you to take them, and pay $50 a month to talk to another doctor on how you're doing, who may or may not understand alcoholism. Our bar program was different, but we set out to save all the drunken lawyers. At the end of the first year, we had 0 lawyers in recovery. We were a complete failure. We had a meeting to decide what we do wrong, and it was so simple that we laughed. We were philosophizing and trying to teach. We weren't using our experience, strength, and hope. So we reverted back to talking about our disease, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. We made videotapes because we couldn't always get 2 or 3 guys to go to somebody's office. And we had one guy who would go with a little camera, built-in video, and play these tapes of 3 about 15-minute pitches on the basic sharing of an alcoholic. The result, at the end of the second year, there were 185 lawyers in recovery. At the end of the third year, there were 450, including 4 judges. We went to the Oregon State Bar and asked them for $2,000 to cover expenses. They didn't see any need for it and turned down our budgetary request. But we kept going, and we made an alliance with the PLF, which is the lawyers' insurance company, and they had privilege, and we joined with them, and that privilege was so important because every year they didn't want to know our statistics. They didn't want to know if anybody was in recovery. They wanted to know if we found anybody doing anything wrong unethically, if there was any imbalance in the checking accounts or trust accounts, if a lawyer was cheating in any way, shape, or form, so they could discipline them. And we wouldn't tell them. And they were threatening us with discipline for not cooperating with them. It was just a real struggle. But eventually it worked out. And now there's about 1,600 lawyers in recovery. And at every bar function, there's a meeting of what they call the second bar. It's like the friends of Bill W. on a cruise. And a meeting in the second bar means an AA meeting. And they're well attended. And we walk in with pride and no fear. And if anybody shows up that we know might be a spy, we're very careful in how we share. Because it's still, they want to know, who haven't we got? And the saddest thing I have to tell you tonight is every lawyer that I helped 12-step who rejected us, within 2 years lost his license. You know, and most of us know when we're thrown out of a house on a 12-step call, there's going to be the loss of job, there's going to be domestic problems, there could be jail, there could be drunk driving charges, and all of that comes to pass. If you're silly enough to pick up the book, read it, follow the 12 steps, you'll walk again and you won't experience any of those delightful things like getting your picture taken with a number in front of you. That's a real benefit, and it's something I know we all strive for. I have found that Alcoholics Anonymous has a unique ability to keep me focused and keep me balanced. I find that if I don't go to 2 to 3 meetings a week, even though this year I've had a lot of illness and I've been making 1 to 2, I don't feel good. Something's wrong. I believe in daily prayer and meditation, and I like to talk to God and just think quietly and ask him to show me his will. And then the courage and power, if I can figure out what it is, to follow through. That is not always easy. And do I make mistakes? Yes. Do I make fewer mistakes than before? Hell yes. And it's really great to be invited to be involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and share. When I think about the fact that I can sit down and realize something is wrong with me and honestly look inside, where did that come from? It came from meeting people like you and sharing with people like you and talking one-on-one. Where do I get the courage to figure out the problem and then find the change and implement it? Because when you make a change, you have to do something that you're not comfortable doing. And you're always afraid you're not going to look good. But the results of the change are usually very positive. And the courage to change, again, comes from participating in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really believe this fellowship has power that has never been tapped and can only be tapped when we make a firm commitment to take an honest look at ourselves on a daily basis, to clean house, to do service work, and to have an opportunity to meet and get to know people like you. I want to thank you very much for asking me. Thank you.